We obviously want to welcome everyone here, but before that, we do need the adoption of the amended agenda. Can I have someone to, thanks, Honourable Hill Lewis, seconded by the Honourable Turkle. Then we need the apologies. I'm only aware of one apology, and that is Honourable Muntush, whose mum is not ill. She's in hospital, so she's not here with us this morning. Honourable Esterhazen is on his way fast-tracking, is it, to energy, I'm assuming. No?
No, Madam Chair, thank you. I've just heard now that I'm a debate on Labour to some of our people is in Nutu, so I must go and prepare. So I'll just sit, be here for the first on debt relief, and then I'll go and prepare something for Labour.
Oh, I see. That's interesting. I believe I'm chairing that plenary, mini-plenary. So there we are, at least there'll be a familiar face. All right. Honourable Kalako.
Sharon also, she's preparing for her speech for the Labour debate.
That's why she's not here. Thank you, Honourable Kalako, our whip. We also have Honourable Sharon van Skalkwyk, who is in Labour and finalising her speech. She would have had two in a row. I think that's everyone, is it? Honourable Lowe, I'm putting this on record now, and I have to, unfortunately. We have endeavoured to get Honourable Lowe to the committee. I understand staff have contacted her. I would like a final call to the EFF office today. But you do know, members, unless you put in an apology in writing, you are marked absent unless there's an exigency beyond your control or medical. So I always like to give new members an opportunity to get things straight, and this would have been her first meeting. Having said that then, can we please look at the people here? We've got Mr. Liso Steto. Well, he isn't here today, no, he's Chief Director, SEZET. Then we've got Mr. Kumkani Sipamandla, Director of CCRD, thank you very much. And, well, of course, I recognize the CEO there of the National Credit Regulator, Ms. Nomsa Machigare. From National Treasury, we do appreciate your presence. We've got Ms. Catherine Gibson, Senior Advisor on the Markets. And then, I hope I'm pronouncing this right, Mr. Finkeely Davidson. Is that right? Director, Financial Stability. Is that right? Finkeely, right. And then, in addition, we have Mr. Obed there. I did see you there, Obed Tongwani. They're also the Deputy Chief Executive Officer, is that right? And then Zandile Nkonyane, Chief Director, the DTI. Well, you know, coming from the DTI itself, you can see that you are then the most senior member of the department. Are you aware of that? Thank you. Members, welcome to you. And the briefing by the National Treasury on the proposed policy on debt relief. Would you please take over there?
Thank you very much, Chair and members. So I think just to give some context, that the presentation today and the feedback today is on the basis of the policy, of course, as well as our inherited experience, I think you can say, over the last few years, working actively with the DTI in terms of the over-indebtedness project. In addition to which, I was present for the previous sitting on this issue where the credit regulator and or the DTI and the NCR spoke more to their policy and took note indeed on the views or the sentiments coming from the committee. So we have tried to respond to this broad collection of issues. I think at the outset it's very important to recognize that we do very much support the wide array of relief reform that's being proposed in terms of the DTI policy. In fact, I think what's particularly important is that it is a comprehensive and it is a wide-reaching basket of reforms. I think the nature of the discussion today is probably going to hinge very much not on that basket in general, but probably more on a particular element of what's being proposed, which is, are we going to be extinguishing debt and for whom? And I appreciate the value in that discussion, but I think we must not, in having that discussion, overlook the number of other very important reforms that are being proposed. Just to highlight then, I think that the context for us presenting any credit reforms is that it must be seen within the broader financial sector as a whole. And that means that any policy objectives which we are trying to achieve in terms of this policy needs to be fit or housed and balanced against the other financial sector policy objectives of stability, financial inclusion and financial integrity and market conduct. I think we can all agree that what we want as an outcome, besides or in addition to the relief of over-indebted or severely over-indebted South Africans, is that we need to do that or find that relief in a way which retains a responsible and sustainable credit market that supports and will continue to support economic growth and development. I think it must also be recognized that given that this is early on in the process, these are just our preliminary views, and we're presenting them in terms of or in support of stimulating and supporting the debate. So again, just before we get into the meat of the issues, we recognize, of course, that the retail lending market is vital to economic growth and development and the well-functioning of the South African economy. And of course, South African government and Treasury in particular have for a number of years in support of the DTI been very concerned about the state of over-indebtedness in South Africa. To highlight again then the 2013 Cabinet decision to authorize the Ministers of Finance and Trade and Industry to take measures to assist over-indebted households and prevent them becoming more over-indebted in future. And there have been a number of initiatives spearheaded across government, be it the DTI, Treasury, Department of Justice, which the DTI has gone into in some detail, I think in the last session outlining what some of those were. And there has been substantial progress made on these. I think the full consequence or the effects of these are yet to be seen. And it will be very important to be monitoring and measuring the effects of these various interventions going forward to see what's working, what's not working, what should we be doing, what could we be doing differently. So as I've said, we feel that the proposals on a whole are comprehensive and well-balanced. We agree, and I think this was reiterated in the previous session, that the rules, if we go the debt relief route, and when I talk debt relief, I'm talking specifically about the debt extinguishing, using I think the language of the DTI, that there must be very strict rules and very clear rules governing how that should be applied, on what would be the trigger, who would be subject to obtain that relief, how much relief, and we believe that those parameters need to be very clearly outlined, preferably in the primary law or governed by the committee, by this committee, obviously in consultation with the various stakeholders involved. And then in terms of the Minister regs, that's more giving effect to what we think that clear policy as it's been spelled out should deliver. What cannot be underemphasized, and this is why I think up front I'd said, I think a lot of the excitement or the whether a lot of the main focus lies is on the actual debt extinguishing, but there are a number of other important reforms which shouldn't be overlooked, including the regulatory enforcement capability of the NCR, and in particular what we see as an internal enforcement mechanism where the NCR itself would be empowered to take enforcement action on its own bat, as opposed to having to relying on a recommendation to the tribunal to give that effect. And also the ability to make settlement agreements. This is in line with what the approach is in the rest of the financial sector regulators. It's how we've modeled out our Twin Peaks regulators, both the Conduct Authority and the Prudential Authority. And I think that going forward, we would also be welcoming engaging the committee and the DTI in terms of the various lessons that we learned in developing that model, because there are a number of improvements which have been suggested, but we think that we can help make those even stronger. Of course, yes, stronger action to be taken against reckless lending. The legal, trying to develop or contain the legal certainty around the Induplum rule, this has been prone to abuse, and it is something which various court or applications through court processes are trying to deal with. But I think a statutory clarity around application of the Induplum rule, in particular to make sure that it covers the whole credit line, right from the interest repayments to the various...
Is it Ms. Gibson? Yes. Whenever you use things like Induplum, just to ensure it's always very clearly understood, some members have only been here a month. You explain it, see? I think you probably come here with a background in financial academics plus experience. MPs are not required to have a financial degree. Thank you.
Yes, well understood. And I think even us with various degrees in economics and law, we still struggle with these terms. So the Induplum rule... in effect, is saying it imposes a cap on the maximum amount that can be obtained by the lender in terms of the amounts of money repaid to that lender. And the issue or the debate stems around whether it's just the interest repayments or whether it actually includes all the various other kinds of fees which may be encountered over the lifetime of that loan agreement, even as it goes into debt collection. So understanding that there's the original lender who will lend the money and be receiving the interest payments, but that lender might be applying fees for late payment or non-payment, and in due course might on-sell that debt, who would then, the debt collector would be charging additional fees, and often that's where it becomes exorbitant. So if we try and limit only one side of that whole chain, obviously what you see is it just creates incentives to start increasing fees elsewhere. Moving on then, improvements to the debt collection framework. This relates to the debt review, the debt review process, and how debt review can be, or the systems around debt review can be tailored to better support the low-income workers, and then wide consultation is promoted in the document in order to include the range of affected government departments, and we are, of course, here today. So we do have extensive comments on the policy document, and we raise questions on various issues. But I think coming out of the last sitting of this committee, what was very clear is that even though the recommendations or the proposals coming forward from DTI, I think, are generally welcomed, I think what was clear is that what was being asked for was much clearer parameters and much in terms of immediate relief for the poorest of the poor. And I think that this is a that this is something which needs to be addressed, and we think it can be addressed, and we would like to support the way in which that happens. So we propose then that we do facilitate the voluntary extinguishing of debt by banks and credit providers for the poorest of the poor. I think there's a critical note here which is around, and there's a question mark as to how this is done, and you'll see that we've said voluntary, and what we mean by voluntary is not that you can select whether you're in or out, but that as an industry you come into the process and commit to the process. And we think that that will be, could be crucial depending on whether, if we go the statutory route, I think that's possible, but there could be constitutional issues raised. Also, I think there's a lot to be said for industry becoming increasingly responsible for the actions it's taken. And we can probably do a lot more with buy-in as opposed to coming at it with a stick. Which is not to say we don't sometimes need the stick, but I think these options need to be explored. When we're talking about the poorest of the poor, I think that there is a question of, well, there will be obviously a question of measurement. I think what has been suggested is there's different ways of measuring it. What came through in the discussions were the no income, no assets persons, also indigents. And there's various ways in which we understand that as government. I think what's important is that when we're looking at these categories of people, that if loans were being issued to these categories of persons, they were probably reckless in the first instance. And so what that means is we can try and, I think, find ways that we can almost proxy for what the DTI has said, as suggested, which I think is also appropriate, where those debts which emerge from reckless lending and have been found emerging from reckless lending should be expunged. But these, by definition, maybe were reckless lending. But those are all open for debate. What is also important is that this isn't just a bank issue. Yes, I think the banks, they do have big balance sheets, and yes, they do have deep pockets, and yes, they can do a lot. But what we've also seen is that as this credit sector has tightened, particularly the lending for coming out of the banks, that hasn't necessarily curbed borrowing to the degree. All it does is it shifts borrowing from the formal to the informal sector, particularly for those who are most desperate and who are caught in a debt spiral. And so it's imperative that we then manage to capture that whole net. How? I think is very challenging, and it's going, again, need to some clever thinking. Also, what we haven't captured here is understanding that sometimes these lenders also onsell their debts to debt collectors. So the big question is, we're not just talking about the lenders, the originators of the debt, but if we're talking about lending from 3, 4, 5, 6 years ago, where is that, who owns that debt now, and how do we deal with that? And so there are obviously complexities within this that we would need to consider. In addition to which, we will need careful engagement on issues like the aggregate level of the write-off, what is fair to industry but will help the poorest South Africans, how many South Africans should be in that group, what are we working towards, who will bear the relative cost across banks and non-bank credit providers? What should be the maximum level of debt per person to be written off? What about the debt already unsold, as I've mentioned? We've also learned from previous relief exercises that what had tended to happen is that, and by relief, it's not necessarily an extinguishment of debt. I think previous relief measures also included cleaning up of the bureau data, which obviously is critical. But what the evidence suggests is that in many instances, in fact, I think in the proportions were very high, and I'm sorry, I don't have them exactly on here, but we can get them, is that those persons who were relieved under that process got back into the same situation within 6 months, or with less than 6 months even. Yeah, so this was here, yes, in South Africa. And I think it's 80-20 who had done the DTI work, they've done work on this, on the effects of the previous relief measures. And I think it would be useful to unpack those further in due course.
The street. Are you saying, because I'm sorry, I had an administrative interruption there, are you saying that previously when this happened in South Africa, people had been forgiven their debt? Because I thought it was a moratorium on the payment of the debt.
Sorry, I'm also talking generally about specifically about the credit bureau cleanup as well that was done. So it wasn't identical to what we're proposing now. It's more the points I'm making is that where people are cleaned, as it were, the effect has been that it has not led to them staying clean. That in fact the debt those persons became on the bureau information, I think. And again, we need to get the information more clear, and I think it would be useful to interrogate the reincidence of that over-indebtedness. So the point as well being that what we're wanting to do and what we need to do is actually change behavior over the longer term. And that's behavior on both sides. It's the demand, it's the borrowers who are taking on too much, and it's the lenders who are lending too much. And when I say too much, I mean inappropriately and irresponsibly. So how can we change that behavior over the longer term? And I think what would be a first best for us is that in support of longer term financial health and wellness, is we actually need to shift from being not only an over-indebted society, but a consumption driven and an overly consumption-reliant society to households which actually save more rather than just not only consuming but borrowing to consume. Then there's the question about who's going to pay and what is the role of the private sector versus the public sector and how can we introduce this in a responsible way to minimize the burden on the fiscus. And of course, whatever steps we take, it cannot compromise the stability of the system at large, the financial system, I mean. And yes, we want to prevent people getting re-indebted soon afterwards. And I think those can all be managed. We just need to be clear that that's what we want to achieve and so that we've got steps in place to manage them. Moving on then, these were just issues around the various proposals and ideas and questions that some questions that we think will be useful to ask and to be discussed going forward. So we had, and so again, these are more on the technical elements of the policy. So the first relates to the support relief for debtors subject to unlawful practices. And there's questions, I think, which would need to be answered around the practical implementation. So for example, on what grounds can the invalid EOOs be rescinded? What is the role of the credit regulator here? In other words, if EAOs have been issued wrongfully, do we set up a system that the individuals involved have to go and apply to the courts, or is the NCR able to do that on their behalf? How would they do that on their behalf? And then the basis of the unlawful social grant deductions? Particularly given the legal uncertainty, well, when I say legal, the recent law cases which have actually said those deductions are legal and out of those bank accounts. For debt relief proposals relating to retrenchments, here again there were questions around, I think the international example had limited this to the NINAs, but I think in terms of our proposals it was presented more broadly, it wasn't just for NINAs, and I think that's got certain ramifications, particularly around moral hazard. I think the question or one of the issues which might come up and what we saw in terms of behavior, and that's why we have to be so careful with behavior and what we incentivize, is with the tax changes to the to pensions and the pension payouts, where in fear that they wouldn't, that government employees or and numerous other employees wouldn't be able to get access to their pensions, they resigned in order to get the pension payout, because it was they saw the need to get that money as so important. Again, with retrenchments, we also need to be careful that we're not then incentivizing voluntary retrenchments in order, not only voluntary retrenchments, but also I think retrenchments can be structured in certain ways to look like they're not voluntary, but they actually have been, they are, and that would be a way to be accessing a write-off of debt. Around that would probably also then need additional protections around limits, caps on how much debt we're talking about. Do you want the writing off, for example, of home loans? But again, those are all questions. And then consider the constitutionality of, by statute, basically relieving people's obligations. And I think we would need to, it would be useful to get a legal opinion in this regard. In terms of the relief criteria, the relief and eligibility criteria that have been discussed, this too was debated to a large extent in the last committee, and I think, as we've said, we very much need to have us reduce or mitigate the risk of uncertainty. So we need to be very clear about what the primary law should say, what are the enabling conditions for the minister, what other factors the minister should consider in making this decision, for example, stability, what is the role of the Reserve Bank governor with respect to systemically important financial institutions. And just to remind the committee that systemically important financial institutions, or SIFIs, are those financial institutions which are so big and are so connected across the financial system, both domestically and at times internationally, that if those institutions are put under strain, they in effect could freeze, and do freeze, the entire financial system. Moving on then away from the relief, the extinguishing of debt issues, I think that this was actually spoken to in more detail and clarified, and I think maybe we had the point that we're making here is that we need to distinguish in terms of reckless lending between the financial institution or the credit provider who is lending recklessly and the directors involved who are making those decisions. And so it's not the institution itself that we think it should be structured as a criminal offence. The reason being is because criminal offences are really cumbersome in order to prove, and they take a long time, and it ultimately also would then mean that the steps taken by the regulator to provide its own internal enforce mechanisms wouldn't be effective in this instance, because they wouldn't be able to exercise those powers in terms of reckless lending. So our view is that for the credit provider involved, reckless lending should be subject to administrative penalties and process, which would be able to be exercised and enforced directly by the credit regulator. But those decision makers, those who are basically responsible for the running of that organization and who have in effect endorsed that behavior, they should be able to be criminally prosecuted. And that way, I think you can get both. We do note with some concern the comment or the statement that the tribunal operating too much as a court of law, as our view is that's exactly why it was set up, to operate as an effective court mechanism. I think we need to be very careful of distinguishing between the role of enforcement and court type processes and administrative sanction, which is very much, it has to rely on the law. It can't be open to interpretation. And it also it's not for the enforcement agents to be saying, to be asking the question, is this law fair or not? If the law is not fair, then we need to change the law. We leave that to the ambit of the ombuds system, of the ombuds. The ombuds have a different mandate and jurisdiction. So ombuds are more of that, they play that adjudication role, and they can and should be able to take matters of fairness, not just what is the law, into account. But in any effect, I think that the what's being proposed in terms of the enforcement mechanisms by the credit regulator, it does mirror the view I've just presented to you, and so I think that we just need to be clear about what our intention is. The enforcement roles of the tribunal and the credit regulator in terms of the changing and the shift, or the shift in enforcement, will need to be very clearly delineated. It is quite a big shift from the system, the enforcement system that is currently operating. Yes, thank you. Is that the Honourable Hilda?
Could I ask a question for clarity on a point just made? I just want to understand the point that you've made in your first bullet. Yes, I am. In your first bullet properly. We are not... Well, I don't think that the proposal was ever that the NCT or the NCR should abandon Audi Ultram Partum. The proposal was that, a concern raised was that the NCT is so hamstrung by legal procedure because it operates in a quasi-judicial manner, but is in fact so close to an ordinary court of law that the difference is hardly distinguishable. So, for example, there are other examples of bodies and organizations in South Africa that are able to make binding findings, binding rulings, but that do not operate on the same basis as a court of law. For example, the CCMA, which is able to make rulings that are binding, but you're not allowed to have legal representation there. And that speeds up the process enormously. And if you have a problem with the ruling of the CCMA, then you can always appeal it to the Labour Court. So the proposal was not, I think you possibly misunderstood the proposal, but I just want to understand exactly the point you're making.
Clarify that and then proceed.
Thank you. Yes, so I think that point is understood and we agree with it. And in fact, our regulators, the Treasury regulators, so what's currently the Financial Services Board, operates on exactly that model. And our new regulators, which are envisaged being the Financial Sector Conduct Authority and the Prudential Authority, also operate on that model. In other words, those regulators are able to, in effect, take, as part of the administrative actions, they're able to take decisions which are binding on regulated entities. And those decisions may be taken in terms of contraventions of the law, as be it either of the primary law or the regulations, which in our regulators can actually issue subordinate regulation as well. So not only is it enforcement of the primary law or regulations issued by minister, they've got additional powers in terms of being able to issue the regulations, and those are also enforced. I think the only point that, and just before I move on, I think it's important that for the reasons that you've highlighted, that's exactly why we've gone that approach, and I think it's consistent with international financial sector regulators. Who need to take strong, swift action. That, however, does need to be balanced against, firstly, the quality of decisions, and how do we make sure that the quality of decisions are good. And so there are various governance processes which have to be built into the mechanism to ensure transparency and accountability. So, for example, what we've provided for in our law is, and under the Twin Peaks Bill, is administrative action panels, which basically are internal to the organization, but provide or allow for an independent eye to be making those decisions, which is separate from the supervisor who's actually day-to-day involved in the online supervision, because sometimes there's conflicts of interest that emerge. What's also critical is that they're transparent and that those decisions are appealable, and they're appealable in a straight, in a way that is not overly cumbersome. And that is particularly important for the small players. So it's one thing for a bank to say, well, you want to appeal our decision, you go to the court. But what if you are an FSP, or what if you are a smaller credit provider? So in our system, we have a tribunal. Well, we're proposing a tribunal, and we have an appeal board at the moment. But that tribunal is then the commensurate to this fast-tracked enforcement, that you then also have a fast-track appeal. And that's set up by, it's made up of past judges and people suitably qualified. You always have access to the courts, because we haven't replaced the court system. So in which case, if you've gone through if a financial institution appeals to the tribunal, keeping in mind this is the future, if they appeal to the tribunal, they don't like the decision, they can then always go to the court.
There is a running tea break. Of course, I don't expect you to put your tackies on, but back.
It will count towards your discovery measurements. I have already then touched on, so the enforcement roles, on this role now between, if we go back to the credit regulator world, I think the roles between the credit regulator and the tribunal are then going to be need to be very clearly defined, particularly now that the tribunal is actually operating as that enforcement role. And so the question is, well, what will they continue to do and how in relation to the Credit Act? And this also then relates to the appeal process. How will the decisions of the credit regulator be appealed? Would the appeal go to the tribunal now? Or in order to promote synergies, what I think would make sense to us is that the appealing of the credit regulator decisions could actually come through to the tribunal that's being established for financial sector regulators and for regulated entities under Twin Peaks. Moving on then away from the structural issues and other matters, questions about if the beneficiaries of the debt relief are not to be listed on the credit bureaus, what are the mechanisms for proposed monitoring the beneficiaries? Funding options need to be further investigated. I think ultimately all the discussion is going to, or a lot of the discussion around, is going to come, how is this going to be funded, who's going to fund, and what proportion, how much, especially across the banks versus non-banks, private versus public portions. And Treasury recommends that the policy explicitly take into account the objective of stability and sustainable access to credit. And I think that this is important because often we, and even our laws, and by our, I'm talking about treasuries, we often focus our laws, and we traditionally have focused them on silos. So the SARB is responsible for stability, for example, without considering inclusion and conduct. The FSB might be responsible for non-bank institutions without considering the impact on the banking institutions. And so one of the main lessons that we've learned is that it's important that regulators and in terms of all of our actions, we have a primary objective, and that has to be clear, but that primary objective needs to be mindful and take into account the other policy objectives. And then lastly, the need for active consumer education around this. I think the DTI is, and the credit regulator are very active in consumer education generally, and I think based on the last presentation on these kinds of issues and on the credit issues in particular, and have increased and become more so, I think that whatever the ultimate, particularly on the debt extinguishment, it needs to be very clearly and well understood by those in the market. And there is an opportunity, I think, here for us to be, again, working together across the credit regulator with the FSB, who also has its, as its mandate consumer education, as well as the SARB, who, interestingly enough, has been engaging on consumer education, particularly around Ponzi schemes, which is very new for them, but it's good. So, yes, I think there's a cooperative approach would be ideal. So in conclusion then, thank you very much for this opportunity. I think that these issues, which have been dealt with and discussed a lot, it has taken a while for us to pinpoint exactly what the various gaps are and how we should be responding to them, and I think this is a good venture to take the process forward. The Twin Peaks process has paved the way for closer cooperation and coordination amongst our regulators. We've already seen it, we've already seen it in terms of just the process and coming to work out how our regulators will work together under Twin Peaks. I think the implementation of Twin Peaks will further strengthen that. And to propose then how to take it forward, we would very much like to work with the DTI on a joint action plan for the extinguishing of debt, which we can then bring to the committee, and that would deal with both banks and non-banks. And in addition to which, as outlined up front, we would again very much like to support the DTI in strengthening its regulatory framework for the regulation of credit providers. What we spoke about today were just some of the issues which were direct responses to the policy and what's contained in the policy. But we think that there's a lot more that we can contribute given our experience in the design of our new Twin Peaks framework. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Gibson. Don't for one moment think of that as a little drum roll. Because I'm sure there'll be quite a tough engagement coming. But thank you very much to you and your colleague there, Mr. Davidson. I'm looking at the committee. I saw your hand first, Honourable Williams, Honourable Hill Lewis, Honourable Easterhuizen, Honourable McPherson, Honourable Kalaku. In that order, please. I'm looking at our time. It's 20 past. Let's try 2 and not stretch it beyond 3. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. Firstly, I just want to say I'm a little bit disappointed in Treasury's input today, because fundamentally it seems to me that they've just been asking questions that we've been asking and then giving us threats. Like, for instance, on slide 5, it says you cannot threaten the stability of the financial system, and I understand. It also goes on to say you must not do A, B, and C, and don't mess with the SIFIs, because, you know, they'll just shut down our financial system. But I want to know, also, Treasury went on to say the decisions that the minister would make. This is a committee bill, and the committee will make the decisions, and the minister will implement those decisions, and obviously we'll get lots and lots of input. But I think you should start looking at it from the point of Parliament. We're here to represent the interests of the people, not the interests of the financial service providers. And I think it's very important that you start realizing that. I also want to just ask, what do you mean when you say the stability of the financial system? Is any debt relief going to threaten the stability of the financial system? And if so, what debt relief won't threaten the stability? And I also want clarity on the stability that you keep talking about. To what degree will debt relief threaten the system? So I just want lots of clarity around your statement saying that we cannot threaten the stability of the financial system. Thank you.
Honourable Williams, Honourable Hill Lewis.
Thank you for the presentation, which I found slightly more helpful than my colleague, in that it did draw together some threads on some fairly complex topics. I don't think there are simplistic solutions to these questions. And I want to just draw out some of those threads a little bit more with you. Firstly, your main proposal, as I understand it, is that we must allow for what already exists under the framework of the DCRS, the voluntary debt forgiveness programs that the banks do run. Now, the problem with that is that the banks make provision, accounting provision, every year to write off a certain amount of debt anyway. So there's no additional cost to them whatsoever. If that's the proposal that you are making, perhaps I misunderstand it. But on average, most of the banks in South Africa have about a 5 to 7% provision for bad debts every year. Some of them, the unsecured lenders, go up to, that number creeps up to 10%, sometimes slightly over 10%. You would know the figures probably better than us. But that is what they essentially budget to write off anyway. So that is already priced into their pricing system for new credit agreements, and there's essentially no cost to them at all. So the proposal has to be over and above that, and the question is how to arrive at that and I completely take the point you've made in a responsible, sustainable way, which seeks to address the fundamental behavior problem from credit providers that they give too much credit to people who can't afford it, and that is our primary concern. And they use their extensive marketing powers and their extensive reach in poor communities to essentially foist that credit onto consumers. Now, again, one of the other threads I want to draw out of your presentation is, and I'm going to be a total stuck record on this, is that the NCA, I believe, is one of the most powerful pieces of legislation in South Africa's arsenal. It is just not adequately used. And the provisions, particularly the provisions on reckless credit. So what is it that we're trying to achieve here? I do not believe we are trying to achieve a very significant subsidy to the banks at the public's expense. In other words, an on-budget financial transfer to the banks. That would reinforce bad behavior. What we are trying to achieve is to stop banks from the kind of behavior that I've just outlined. And the way to do that is to force them to take a financial loss when they engage in that kind of lending practice. And for me, the best way to do that is through the reckless credit provisions. That ensures that they recover nothing of the reckless credit that they dish out, because the act fully empowers us to write off all outstanding capital, interest, fees, and to refund the consumer everything they've paid up until that point. That is the severest penalty that any financial institution essentially can have for engaging in that kind of practice. And that is where our attention needs to focus, I believe. So those two questions, please, in the first 3 minutes.
Thank you, Honourable Hill Lewis. Honourable Eersterhuizen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is also about financial institutions and about debt forgiveness. I think blanket debt forgiveness would accelerate irresponsible borrowing. And one of banking system foundation principles is of efficiency and legally lend money, and of course to collect repayments, and I'm sure gates circumstances and offer means of repayment based on those circumstances. The NCR, I also agree that there is existing laws in place. The NCR must protect the poor from unregistered and immoral money lenders. The reckless lending of financial markets must be dealt with using existing laws. We don't need new laws or legislation for debt relief. We that would have negative consequences for the legal financial institutions and the economy as a whole. The growth rate, as pathetic as it is largely subsidized by the poor, and most of those who do not qualify. You know, I actually said it yesterday in Trade and Industry, the consumers are continuously driven in this current financial climate by feelings of anxiety about the ability to make ends meet. And unfortunately, this drives them to even more desperate measures and even more expensive money, lending more expensive money. The draft of the Collectors Amendment Bill in court cases has more highlighted the flagrant abuses in the collection of debt. And I think the existing laws should be used in it. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Yesterhazen. Honourable McPherson.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, National Treasury, for your presentation. I think that what you've done, certainly for myself, is you've brought the conversation, which was starting to sort of veer into strange realms, to very pointed questions and to a very pointed place. And you've asked a lot of questions, but you haven't given, you haven't answered most of those questions. And I think that it's what would be helpful, and I think that you've certainly started the conversation on some really important topics that we as a committee need to discuss. And maybe once we've started having those discussions, it would be great to have you to come back to answer those questions. But particularly around the what the costs to the financial sector and ultimately to the economy would be if we went down this road. Because at the end of the day, it will cost the economy something. Someone has to pay for it. At the end of the day, you can't write off debt without someone else paying for it. So that would be the first thing. The other thing that I'll come back. Sorry.
Thank you, Honourable McPherson. Honourable Kalaku.
Chair, I also share what the colleagues are raising. Let me maybe my shallow understanding of what we're trying to do as a committee in looking into debt relief. I thought we were trying to address, you know, the present situation of poor people and the way people are victimized by banks, finding themselves paying, in fact, double than through this interest system. I thought we were dealing with that, but it's becoming complicated now with your questions. I know. Of course, you have to help us along. I know Treasury and DTI, whilst applying, there are acts which are there. But as colleagues have said, there are acts which can be used to protect consumers, to protect the poor. But you know the majority of our people, they are not sometimes even aware of that. And in fact, to use that protection, they have to go to lawyers and pay more. So these are, I think, we're trying to mitigate around that. It's not that we're saying the financial sector must be squeezed. It's true that we are not living here in a socialist system. We are in a capitalist system. You will have to pay for whatever thing you do. But our major problem is because the other thing I don't want to happen here, because of these economic conditions we are under now globally and in the country. It's worse in the country here. Yeah. And we are starting to feel it. If you have a family, you feel it. I feel it every day. If you go to shops today, transport, everything. If you want to know what is junk status, we know it practically. It's not a theory. So what will not want to happen is actually to further burden the fiscus. If you can look and answer those, how do we go around that? Because really, if you say, okay, write off, who will pay? That question will always be there. And private sector won't leave us alone on that. I'm sure they will argue, the financial sector, around that. So to me, Chair, I think if they can clarify on that as they are working along, and I agree with the colleague, they must come back. We engage further as they are leaving us with this. Together with DTI, you come back, we engage further. And real, I know sometimes laws, which of course they are meant for regulating the behavior of people, us, how we behave and how we actually relate to each other. Laws are simply meant for that. So because we are not animals, we are people, we are human beings. So if you can come back to us and point in these existing acts that, look, members, if this can be simplified, can be worked, you know, a colleague Lewis was doing, he made a good question, I mean, example of CCMA, and when you go back to courts. So if you can come back to us with that, because at the same time, you must know South African community, especially society, the majority of people, we don't have a culture and tradition of saving. We don't save, the majority of our people. We don't have, because it's not there. It's under these conditions. That is why even if they are relieved, they go immediately back to debt. So we must take into consideration when we deal with this, all those facts and elements. Thank you, Jean.
Thank you very much. Honourable Kalako, Honourable MacPherson, you wanted to complete your question.
Sorry, I had a senior moment. You know, being in Parliament's aged me somewhat over the last 3 years. it is scary. I wanted to discuss the concept of you know, this idea that some people have of, you know, just sort of write all the debt off, because I think that that's the extreme view, and I think that we need to work away from that towards a more moderated view, because if what you're saying is true, that studies have shown that a big majority of those people just get re-indebted once again, to my mind, it would be pointless trying to change that behavior if it's going to just continue to repeat itself. So the solution then is not just to keep writing off debt continuously if people are just going to continuously keep getting back into that position, but it's to stop those people getting into that position in the first place from lenders. So if we agree that that is actually the solution, then we need to look at what are the instruments to stop them doing that. Now, the Honourable Hill Lewis has articulated quite well and repetitively, like a stuck record, that actually the NCA, and I can call him that because he's my friend as well, that the NCA largely empowers the NCR to stop people doing that in the first place. But it's not being done. So I'm still confused as to why we want to try and stop something from happening which can be stopped already. And that's a question that we as a committee need to look at and understand. And then I want to talk to the, or I'd like to, sure, you'll give me an opportunity because of my senior moments, but with respect to your point about considering constitutionality. You said it's something that we need to gain a legal opinion about, but obviously you've put that because you have an opinion that there may be a constitutional problem. Can you share what National Treasury's consideration is around constitutionality? Because you've obviously obtained a legal opinion already. So it's just it's something that you're concerned about. But if you can give me what section of the Constitution this may violate. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honourable MacPherson. I just, I'm wondering, I know Treasury really applies its mind to these things when it pops in to clarify certain things and give us their position on it. But we had a very interesting study given to us, shared with us, the feasibility of a debt forgiveness program. That was about a year after we first raised this in the previous term. We got that in April 2015, some of us will recall. And, you know, you raise pointers like the stability of the system, the this, the that, other issues that have been raised in the committee. Oh, this can't look like an election ploy, which happened in one or two countries. But in countries, the UK debt refunds, there have been numerous examples of refunds to customers who have been subject to reckless lending practices, full stop. That's it. That was reckless lending. You'll get your money back. Now, I didn't hear this tone coming out from you. I heard what finance, coming out with finance, if it is invalid, I think it would, on what grounds can invalid EAOs? Well, if it's invalid, it's invalid. If you've gone through a red robot, you've gone through a red robot. I find that this is a little back to front here. Maybe it was a typo. The other issue is that some of our sanctions and practices around debt involve the judicial system. This isn't always the case when looking at debt in all countries, as it were. Now, that may be a further complication in our case. But when it comes to Treasury, and I do want to correct something, that no debt has ever been extinguished of anyone other than a bank or a lending institution, not the ordinary person. So let's get that clear, absolutely clear. At the end of the day, you still owe that money. This will be the first time under a democratic dispensation that this would even have been considered. So I want that cleared now because I am tired of it being said on radio, on TV, that we've had this before. We have not had it before. Let's get that clear. And that is why we are saying just as National Treasury has from time to time in the interest of the stability of the economy looked at ways of enabling institutions to write off certain things. And the other interesting thing is we all know write off means nothing. It means putting it under the desk and bringing it up a few years later. So I liked your concept of extinguishing, you know, burning the darn thing out. But nothing else. So I think the time has come in the same way we have dealt kindly with financial institutions, retail institutions, that we ought to give the people of South Africa, faced with certain challenges, and I do agree, comprehensive criteria, that I do agree with. We can't have just anyone coming in and saying, I owe this, can you let me off, as it were. But we've got numerous examples here of countries taking a strong hand, backed by their national treasuries and reserve banks or federal banks, and that being the case. And no one ever called them irresponsible. And I do want us to look at this clearly. There isn't anyone sitting here who wants to bring down the stability in our country. We are deeply concerned about that. We want responsible behavior, and those who flout the law, there is a law that says don't lend irresponsibly, recklessly. Well, why aren't they sitting in jail or paying? Is it okay? Is it okay, National Treasury? No. So let's deal with it. Thank you.
Okay, so I think I should start with, there were a lot of questions, and they were all good questions, and a lot of comments, and they were good comments. I think I should start with the main issue, which is, what are we as Treasury actually saying? And what we are actually saying is that we believe that there should be a process in place to facilitate the extinguishment of debt. Beyond what is currently enabled through the debt counselling and the existing processes. And that should be a permanent writing off, and it should be a permanent writing off for those people who most need it. And it should be done in a way which tries to change the culture, the behavior of the sector. And that's where you're dealing with the lenders and the borrowers. So in other words, there is moral hazard on both sides. The moral hazard of the lenders is that they can lend recklessly and they still get paid for it. The moral hazard on the borrowers is they can borrow recklessly and get there and get it removed. So how do we get the balance in between that? That's why I think it's important to find the proxy for where those loans were rendered recklessly in the first instance. So who are those people that just by looking at who that person is, and if you were to look at that person's bank account, and they cannot show that they've got assets, and they cannot show that they've got income, and they haven't had income for a whole over the period of the loan, how was it that that person was able to obtain a loan in the first instance? In terms of going back to the first question, I think from Mr. Williams, and I think this also relates to the question about whether we're trying to, with the threats we're making about stability, etc. That's definitely not the case. I think what it comes down to is we need, what is the number? Like what is the size of the value of the debt that is going to make a significant amount of difference to the right people and the right number of people. And that, where we get on, so it's definitely not zero. The question, though, is how, I mean, I expect we're talking into the millions. The question is how many millions? Are we going into billions? And if we're going into, so this is where you start getting onto the spectrum of when will it impact the system and when will it not? Because if we take the extreme, so zero is going to benefit no one. If it was a trillion, that is going to create severe moral hazard and arguably disrupt the system. The question is, where in between are we sitting? And I think that's where we need to do more work, because we need to know who these people are. What are the size of the loans that they have against them? What is the aggregate value of these loans? And be working that out, balancing it against how much can the credit providers absorb before it kicks into something which is more disruptive. I think then going to some of the more technical questions, I think on the relying on the DCRS, I think I've answered no. It's not just, I think that there are proposals to improve the DCRS, and we support those, but what we are considering goes beyond that. In terms of the legislation and the Credit Act and the powers in place, I think that's probably more fair for the credit regulator and the DTI to answer. I think on reckless lending, there's a question around, and this is a question we ask ourselves in terms of even the way that laws are crafted. So often laws might provide for something, like you provide for reckless lending. The question is, how is that law written that you would actually enforce reckless lending? So can you enforce it based on a rule In other words, does it have to be a fixed number? I think based on the affordability criteria that have been introduced, so there weren't affordability criteria. Does that mean de facto that you weren't recklessly lending because there weren't those criteria? I don't know. But what I do know is the way that we are very conscious in terms of drafting our law going forward is that we are now making sure that if you we make very sure what the principle is, in addition to what the rules, what the actual implementation of that principle is, which means is the principle, it has to be a reckless lending to take that example. The principle must be you must not lend recklessly. That's the principle. You should be able to enforce against that principle and be able to improve against that principle. That can be backed by specific requirements, which make it a lot easier to enforce because then you just have to show contravention. But it does probably need to be a balance of those two. When you start getting into those kinds of questions, it then does go to how the regulators actually function. And this isn't a comment on the credit regulator. I can talk more about our own regulators. So our regulators have traditionally been very rules-focused. In other words, they look for, this is what the rule says, and we're going to get your returns in, and we're going to make sure that you are ticking those boxes, often with missing what the spirit of the law is, which is why we are now crafting our laws in such a way that the regulators need to be concerned with the spirit of the law in addition to the actual rules, and we're giving them the right kinds of powers that they can do that. But it does lead to complexity around capability, capacity issues, because it means that regulators need to start making judgment decisions, and that's hard. In terms of the blanket debt forgiveness being problematic and we don't need new laws, I think I've spoken to this a bit. I think that it's not a straightforward answer. We do have existing laws. They can be enforced. What we've seen across those different laws, whether we're talking about the Credit Act or the various laws under the Department of Justice, is that they were just left, not the Credit Act, but these other laws were probably just left alone for too long. And so debt collection practices, the way in which debt's enforced, the gaps there, there is some protection, but it wasn't enough. And we've had to revisit those laws, and they are being revisited and have been revisited. I think the very nature of when you've got multiple laws, and I think this has also been our major learning and why we've moved towards our Twin Peaks system and trying to consolidate our various pieces of sectoral legislation, is because it's really hard to get multiple pieces of laws to line up. So now we're talking, if you think about what the whole chain is of credit, right from the original lending, and the original lending is not just the lending practice, it's actually the management of the original capital in order to lend in the first instance. So now you're even going from where is the money that you're lending, where is that money coming in the first place? Is it coming from deposit takers? Is it coming from the markets? And so you're trying to see right from there all the way to the end of the debt collection and the court processes. So yes, laws are there, but yes, very much there are going to be gaps, particularly given that you've got different agencies overlooking those various pieces of legislation and that they're in different states and trying to do different things, which is not to say it can't be done, and it's not to say that it's not correct. And for example, of course, justice would be responsible for the court acts, but it's challenging. I think that's also been why it's been so important for government as a whole to be looking at the challenge of over-indebtedness, the problems of over-indebtedness, because it does reach across all these different issues. Can the laws be better enforced? Again, I think we need to speak to the specific regulators and the departments to answer on their pieces of legislation. The cost of the economy and the sector, I think this is generally what I've spoken about already. Just to highlight that we are needing to balance right. We need to get the impact right. So it's getting maximum impact for the poor while maximum impact for the poor to get rid of debt that they shouldn't probably have had in the first instance, in a way which I think the credit providers are definitely going to feel the impact. but they shouldn't be crippled as a result. Crippled as a result. Crippled. I'll make up new words. Dictionary.com. I've heard and I've said far worse. Just checking what else if I've left. Oh, the constitutionality issue. So this is on the basis of our internal discussions between our legal team and our administrative action experts, if I can call it that, administrative processes. And the view is that, and it's a very basic view, which is that if you take away something from someone that belongs to them, expropriation, and you don't compensate, and they're not wanting to give it to you, we're not allowed to do that in terms of our constitution. And in effect, this is what you're taking away, an asset, which is the income stream is in effect, and the income stream of the of what's owing is in effect an asset. There was a chair, I think you had asked about the EAOs, and so that was definitely not about the principle of wrong EAOs, of invalid EAOs. The question was, these are the practical implementation, it's a question of how do we go about doing that. So we can be very clear what the grounds are, that they're invalid. The challenge, though, is the process in terms of, so even if we've identified that that EAO is invalid, who identifies it? Because it was actually issued by the court. So that means the court needs to rescind it. But that means we can't then de facto just say that we're rescinding it, or can we? Or do we have to go to court to ask them to rescind it? And if we go to court, who would go to court? Is it Parliament? Is it the individual involved? Do we just set up that process? Is it the credit regulator? Do they have the right to actually do that on behalf of someone else? And so it was very much just those process and implementation kinds of questions. So a lot of the questions or the issues, the question marks, are not against the principle. I think we very much are in favor of the principle. It's just that there are a lot of question marks because we need to make sure that we do this in the right way. And noting, thank you, that the debt hasn't been extinguished. And also just to highlight, that wasn't my word. I think that was a word I took from, I hijacked from, I think it was the DTI. Funny. All right, and on that, I think I have dealt. I think I have dealt with. But if there are any follow-up questions, I will take those. Thank you.
I think we do just have 5 minutes. But the thing is, we've got to deal with an important matter of the study visit. So what I propose, because I can see that is what all members would like, is another engagement, a longer engagement. Are we in agreement there? And so I'm looking at all of you, and I'm looking at next Wednesday, the 31st of May, in which you start off with a subcommittee on debt relief. Do you see that? Do you see that? Yes. I think it would be useful to start off with the committee itself, if we can persuade Ms. Gibson and her colleagues, National Treasury, to come along to us then, because we're nowhere near finished. We do need to engage a lot more. Now, clearly, you need to engage with your management and those who approve your, flights out of work, as it were. So, I'm going to, I see here that the CIPC, I'm just told here, just one moment, the CIPC is launching, so we're supposed to go to that early. But that's not all morning, and I'm wondering if we couldn't make it later that morning, depending on the plenaries. Is that clear? Depending on the plenaries. And remember, even if there's a plenary, if we're dealing with legislation, we can continue during that time. So we would like you to see when we can get you back next week. Can I put it that way? Yes, so please, Ms. Gibson, if you can respond.
So we, of course, will come back if you ask us. I think the question, though, what do you want us to come back with? And so the question is, if you're wanting us to come back with, if it's more, to, if it's to engage on and have a more of an open discussion, then next week is fine. If you're wanting us to come back with more numbers and firm proposals, I'm not sure a week is going to be adequate.
Briefly, Honourable McPherson.
I mean, I think it's important to start actually putting some, in my mind, some numbers to this thing, because these are just sort of general discussions on feelings and opinions. So I would certainly like to start seeing some raw numbers and some raw data around what this discussion leads to. I'd certainly like to see a concrete legal opinion at some point, whether that comes from National Treasury, from the DTR, or from the NCR. I'm not really fazed who it comes from. Also, I'd like to know, what engagements, whoever it is, whether it's DTR, National Treasury, or the NCR, are having with the banks and, credit providers. And I'd like to start seeing, on paper, what are the discussions, what are their responses, sort of thing. So, because all we're doing is we just, much like the Joint Committee, on financial sector regulation, just keep talking, not actually getting to anywhere. I'd like to start getting, some evidence on the stuff.
As far as I'm aware, isn't this our first engagement with National Treasury? I could be wrong. So on this matter, so I don't think it is sufficient time for us to have concluded things, because we do know we need to work with National Treasury in certain areas. We know that. So I think we've heard sufficient for the study group, not the study group, the subcommittee also to look at it, and the subcommittee itself may wish to engage, finance further. Do you follow? So rather than make a snap decision on this one, I would like to put it to you that we do need to just fine-tune a few pointers, and I will consult with the chairperson of the subcommittee, Honourable Williams, on the matter, so that we can see. But I am asking in principle if you will return. That's it. So that we do have. Thank you very much on that point. And thank you for engaging with us here this morning. Members, I'd also like you to study this again. Some very interesting points here, like the one I was reading on the United Kingdom, affecting customers who had been subject to reckless lending practices, notwithstanding their economic environment of the time. So I'm only asking us, review things. I know the study group, the subcommittee is Honourable Hill Lewis.
I wanted to make one additional point for our further engagements, notwithstanding the point that we must make progress, but we must make progress in a responsible and financially and economically sustainable way. I would like to have a brief engagement with someone senior from the Department of Justice, because emolument attachment orders are such a central issue in debt forgiveness. Now, we've heard for a long time that they are doing a lot of work, and that, again, in Ms. Gibson's presentation today, they say that they have made progress on, but I would like to see what progress they've made and how far along they are, because the Decide judgment was a very powerful judgment in the Stellenbosch Law Center case. But, of course, it only applies to one case. So we've now got to find a way of expanding that scale of the implications of that judgment across the board. And so I think it would be useful to engage on that. The other thing that I recall about a year ago, I might be wrong, the National Treasury engaged in an audit of all emolument attachment orders on all public servants across the country on your Purcell system. Now, it would be really interesting to see the results of that, because that is a huge exercise in debt forgiveness, essentially. And so I'd like to know whether that process is finished and how many of those emolument attachment orders were removed from the payment system.
You've made two very solid proposals, Honourable Hill Lewis. It's always been acknowledged that Department of Justice is, you know, involved. But I think that we need to get this down clearly and ensure that they are invited, and it could be constructive, maybe if Treasury is here at the same time, finance, you see. So let's take that up. And secondly, the example you made, I've asked Mr. Medema to pursue that in writing to the relevant department. Is that, are we all on board? And then I'll consult with the Honourable Williams just to see where we are with the subcommittee on the matter. But while we're talking of that Wednesday, so thank you very much to finance, Ms. Gibson and Mr. Villani. The issue around the CIPC, which is very important, they're launching a major office here in Cape Town to take care of the Cape, as it were, broadly. And it is a very important regulator. It deals not only with huge companies and corporates and small business, but cooperatives as well as many other things. And the intellectual property laws amendment bill under which the performers come. All right. So I think it would be very constructive if we took up the invitation seriously, but made it part of our committee meeting proceedings, etc. So I will come back to you in writing to members on that matter. But that would be Wednesday. We also will be looking at when to proceed with the performers, and it's clear that we need to make that start on the same Wednesday. So we will brief you as to how we will approach it in timing. Currently we do 8:30 to 10:30 or something, but we may have to go right through to 1300, but outside the Parliament, as it were. I will come back on that one. For the issue that I asked us to add to the program, the study visit, we had reached an agreement in principle that we would pursue debt on the study visit, have a look and see what had been done. But at the same time, to make the trip really, adding value, we should look at it, something else. And what other legislation is on the table is the issue. And as we know, gambling is on the table in a way, so is the liquor coming up. So there are those two areas. But we can also, and this I believe would be very constructive, the fourth industrial revolution is here. It's knocking. It's now the door is open to it. And according to researchers, the country that has made really great progress in this regard is Germany. Now, Germany is very close, you know, it's relatively close to Croatia, which is what one put forward for the debt. So this is what we are pursuing at the moment. I have asked for seven people to go, members of the study of the committee. I know that definitely five will go, but I'm pressing because it's two issues that we're able to extend it beyond the five. And your respective political parties make their own decisions, but I would imagine in this case it would be the Honourable Hill Lewis for the debt issue, because aren't you in the subcommittee? But that is the decision there. All right, members, and the ANC, I'm sure, will have their own discussions and brief one in that regard. And then on that particular note, there's no meeting tomorrow on Thursday. Our next meeting is not this Friday. Is not this Friday. However, I'm looking at those who are in Manco. We are going to have a management committee meeting this Friday, and that applies to the relevant staff members as well. All right? I would like to thank the CEO, Mr. Gari, and the team for being here. We are making progress. and we appreciate the support that you are giving us in this regard. But let us never forget, this is a committee bill. It is our bill. And I think there are different dynamics when it is a committee bill, and we need to respect those dynamics. And I would like to thank you very much. Meeting adjourned until next Tuesday. All right? And it says 9.